In this, a part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about adoption and talking about the ways that adoption within the last couple of decades that adoption has changed and how it is also changing America. And our guest for the program is Adam Pertman. He reports on family and children's issues for the Boston Globe and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his work on adoption. He's the author of a book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of his book is Adoption Nation, and the subtitle, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming America. It's published by Basic Books and has come out fairly recently. If you would like to call in, ask questions, make comments, that's certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to give us a call, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, so if you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal will travel, and it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Pertman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure to be here.
It's one of the statistics that you have in the book that's very striking that makes the point of how adoption, how many people in this country are touched one way or another, is this. You write in the book, there apparently are something between 5 and 6 million adoptees in the U.S. today, about triple the number that experts estimated just a few years ago. If you add in birth parents, adoptive parents, biological and adoptive brothers and sisters, the number of people directly connected to adoption soars into the tens of millions. And you say, in fact, it might even be more than that because there are some adoptees who still don't know that they were adopted. And it does, once you start thinking about this and all the various connections, it is indeed something that it may not touch everyone, but touches an awful lot of people.
Well, I would even argue and do that it does touch everyone because we all come into contact with adopted people, with adoptive parents, with birth parents, the ones we know that we come into contact least. But, you know, these kids come from somewhere. They come from real human beings who gave them up for adoption, and those people are all around us as well.
Hmm. And I guess I should have mentioned here just one detail about you is that you and your wife have two adopted children.
An important detail, a wonderful one, I might add.
So it's definitely something that you have personal experience with.
Oh, absolutely, and it was the first thing that drew me to the topic. I mean, everybody's interested in the things that affect them, which is, I mean, indirectly, why I wrote the book, because I really do believe that this affects more people than realize it, and as a result, their behavior affects us in the direct adoption community, just as our behavior affects them. And I think, to the largest extent, we don't understand how that works because adoption has been secret for so long. And so the book was very much meant to let people know how they fit into this world.
And I think there you point at what has been the biggest change, and that is now we are talking about it, and to a large extent, the kind of shame that was associated with placing a child for adoption or with being adopted, by and large, is now gone.
Thank God. I mean, you know, for generations, literally for generations, the women who created these children and men were considered, you know, baby-making machines. They're supposed to make their babies and go away and be shamed and embarrassed and hide the rest of their lives. The adoptive parents were supposed to be so embarrassed about not having their own biological children. You know, how many times still do people say, oh, I'm sorry, you couldn't have your own child? Well, my adopted kids are my own children. Mm-hmm. It's okay. And you're adopted was an insult, right? A slur. So it's a good thing that this thing, we're talking about it, and that the stigmas and the stereotypes are finally lifting.
Although not, I think also when one would hasten to add, as I'm sure that you would, this is something that is a work in progress.
Oh, absolutely.
And that some of those attitudes are still in place.
Oh, absolutely. This revolution that I describe is very much ongoing. I mean, we're getting to a better place, and we're doing it pretty rapidly, but we're by no means there yet.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about all of the sides of the adoption triangle.
Sure.
And some of the challenges, the difficulties, and also the rewards. And perhaps we would start with talking a little bit about people who are interested in adopting. And I think that the thing that you point out is that it is in a sense, the story is the same all the way around the triangle, that it's difficult, it's confusing, that from place to place the rules are very different, and that if you have a person or persons who are interested in adopting right at the very beginning, it can be very confusing and ask, you know, getting an answer to the basic question, well, what do I do? How do I start? Where do I go? Is not an easy task.
It's not. And actually what's interesting is the result of that, of all that confusion and lack of knowledge, is that most people tend to adopt in the way that their friends and neighbors did. In other words, I think the main reason my wife and I adopted domestically, an infant domestically, is because we had friends who did that. So we went to that agency because it all seemed so confusing and there was so much we didn't know. We just wanted to cut through it. I think when you see people who have children from, just pick one, from China, they have friends with children from China,
mm-hmm.
because they knew that that worked. They knew how it worked. They could find out some easy access to information. And the same is true with foster care. You see those numbers going up because, in large part, because of federal laws, but also because people see, oh, my goodness, you know, you can really love a five-year-old who came out of foster care even though he has special needs and it looks like a wonderful family. Well, we couldn't know that when it was a secret. We can learn it when we see it with our own eyes, and we're seeing it with our own eyes. So it is way too complicated a process. The laws from state to state don't mesh. They conflict to a large extent. It causes much more expense and much more grief for everyone concerned than it ever needs to. I say in the book that we regulate and monitor the sale of air conditioners more than we do the transfer of a child from one family to another. You know, that secrecy, that lack of observation and monitoring causes problems. It causes all sorts of problems in all sorts of areas. The good news, because I don't want people to say, oh, my God, I don't want to get into this. The good news is that it's getting better, but it's getting better because we're finally talking about it.
Hmm. Why is it that there's so much difference in the rules and regulations surrounding adoption from one state to another, or maybe even within a state, from one place to another?
Oh, and you can go even further. You can go from one jurisdiction within a state. You can go from one courthouse to another in a state, and you can go literally from one judge to another in the same courthouse, and they interpret the laws differently regarding adoption. It is not a pretty picture. The reason is that adoption grew up in this country as a state's rights matter. If the federal government dictate some aspects of foster care, because those children are in government custody formally, but the federal government does not touch adoption because it's considered a state matter. And as a result of it being a state matter, we have 50 states with 50 different states, sets of laws, 50 sets of interpretations, 50 sets of guidelines. I mean, it can be a bureaucratic maze. One of the chapters in Adoption Nation deals specifically with that. I think it is getting a little better. That is one of the areas that needs the most work, in my view. And I hope that, you know, through the book and through people talking about this for the first time, and I hope through a clamor from pre-adoptive parents, that people finally say, enough of this. You know, enough secrecy, enough privacy is fine. But when secrecy leads to messes like this, it is not a positive thing for anyone involved.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Adam Prittman. He is a reporter for the Boston Globe. He writes about family and children's issues, and he's the author of the recent book, Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming America, published by Basic Books. So if you're interested in the subject, you can look at the book. And if you have questions or comments, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What now is the range of cost for adoption?
It can be quite expensive. Anywhere, I would say, from $15,000 to $35,000 and up for a healthy white infant within the United States, and pretty much the same cost for a child from abroad. Foster care costs nothing. Foster care often has subsidies, in fact, attached to it. The costs are, I have a chapter in the book called The Money's the Problem. The money is a problem. I think there are certain costs that absolutely are important. You want the legal aspects of an adoption taken care of properly. You want the social work done right. You want counseling to be done. You want people involved to get a paycheck. So there certainly are reasonable costs. But when you see adoptions by a private agency, and I'm making up these states, in Minnesota charging almost exactly the same thing as a lawyer, in Baltimore charging almost exactly the same thing as a nonprofit organization in Illinois, you say something's going on here. There's some reason. Why are all these costs almost exactly the same? And I think the reason is market forces. And when we put children, people's lives, and dollar signs into the same sentence, I think that's trouble. And I think we have caused some trouble, and it's the result of the secrecy in adoption. Nobody's been paying attention to this stuff. So market forces kick in. And I don't want market forces affecting children. I think that commodifies them. It locks out a lot of people who can't afford the money and could be very good parents and could give kids very good homes, but who can't do it. So money is a real issue, and I think we need to tackle it. It's not being tackled. It's one of the problems that I hope people will focus on more as a result of the book. I think that'll help a lot of people if they do.
Well, you partly answered. Maybe you've given the best answer you can to the next question I was going to ask, and that is, what is it that people are paying for when they're paying these large fees? So part of it is legal fees, but
let me just toss one more comment in there, if I may.
Sure.
Because I think it's really critical that we do not think of it as paying for children.
Mm-hmm.
And we are drawn into that temptation because of the way the process too often works. Oh, how much did you pay for that? Meaning that child, not that adoption. Well, we don't want to be in the business of even thinking about our children as commodities that we purchased. We're paying for services. And we have to, even when there's bad stuff going on that we need to fix, as a matter of social policy and intellectualization of this whole process, we have to think about it as fees for services required, in the same way as a mother who doesn't have health insurance winds up in the hospital for 6 months because she has some complications and has to find a way to pay the doctors and probably some lawyers and maybe a social worker to help her get through all that. She did not pay for that baby. She paid for the services required to let her have that baby, and the same is true in adoption.
We've talked a little bit about how things are changing because the whole process is becoming more open because now people are more open to the idea of adoption. We're talking about it so that it seems less, some of the shame of placing a child being adopted has worn out. But all of this, as people get more interested in adoption, as that occurs, it occurred at the same time that single people are raising their own children. People continue to want to have healthy infants, and so for a number of reasons, the interest in adoption and the interest, I hesitate to say demand for children, but I guess that's what we're talking about.
That's what it is.
Is going up at the same time that the supply of the kind of children that people want, that is healthy infants, has declined, and that's why you get into
the revolution.
Right.
It's a confluence of a lot of historical events. My book is very much sort of, I hesitate to call it a sociological historical text, though that's what it is. Because then nobody will read it. It's written through people's stories. It's written through dramatic stories of pain, of loss, of joy. One soap opera after the other, if I may. But the point really is a historical sociological one. What you got at the critical notion here, 50 years ago, something on the order of 80% plus of all unmarried women gave up their babies for adoption. 80% plus. Today that number is under 3% because we as a culture have started to accept single parenthood. What happens now? The other historical phenomenon that's occurring is aging baby boomers starting families late, like my wife and I did. So we aging baby boomers discover we want to form families, can't do it the old-fashioned way. We turn to adoption. There are fewer and fewer white infants for all these aging, for these older white people. You can also add, by the way, overlays of gay adoption, single older people adoption, people who are disabled adopting. All these things are happening at the same time. Overlay the fall of the Soviet Union, which led us to understand that there were hundreds of thousands of children in need of homes and institutions in Eastern Europe, wars in Latin America, which left a lot of kids in need of homes, and China adopting a single-parent policy, single-child policy, which led to the abandonment of a lot of baby girls. So you put all of these things together, and they converge into people in America who want to have families suddenly not adopting those white babies who are, the supply of which is lower and lower and lower. They're turning elsewhere. They're turning to foster care. They're turning abroad. And it is changing the nature of family in America because you have white people all over this country raising children who look different than they do, who are from different cultures, who are from different nations. We're importing, in a sense, new cultures into our country in a brand new historical way, not through waves of immigration, but through adoption. It's a fascinating phenomenon.
Well, that's another really interesting angle here, and another of the statistics that's very striking that you talk about in the book is the fact that Americans adopt more children from abroad than all of the people of the rest of the earth combined.
That's right.
And that particularly it's something that we've seen in about the last 50 years. There was some international adoption. After World War II, there was a significant number of children from Korea that came after the Korean War. Since the end of the Cold War, Americans have been adopting children, as you say, mentioned from Eastern Europe. And then most recently, there's been this big spike up in adoptions from China. One wonders, though, given the fact that domestic adoption is complicated enough, why do this? Why add this extra layer of complication, having to go to another country, dealing with officials, perhaps of a foreign government, dealing with the issue of immigration, dealing with the health concerns?
Sure.
And all this, it sounds like it's just so much, it would be so much more difficult than domestic adoption. I'm not sure what pushes people to do that.
Well, a lot of things push people to do it. One of the things, and in no particular order, is that some people don't want. Adoptions are very much open today. I mean, people are very surprised to learn that in the overwhelming majority of adoptions today, the birth mothers, the women who give birth to the children, pick the new parents for their children. Some people don't want, I think they're wrong to do it, but they do not want the complications involved in having that relationship with their children's birth parents. And so they go abroad. So that's one reason people do it. Though they often come to understand that they wish they had more communication with the birth parent because of health information, genealogical information. But in any case, it's one reason. Another reason is for humanitarian reasons. They see children who really need homes badly for the same reason that a lot of people turn to foster care, because they think these are children who really need homes. And the third reason, big reason that people go abroad, and maybe the biggest, is it's a certain process. However complicated it may be, they're almost guaranteed. I mean, there are so many kids who need homes. They're almost guaranteed that they will form a family. They will get a child. Whatever the process entails, at the end of it, they're going to have a family, and they like that certainty. So there are a lot of reasons. Some are good, some are bad, some are whatever the reasons. They wind up with a family that they're thrilled with, and that's a good. And the kid winds up with with parents that he or she never had. Those are good things.
There's again, sort of an interesting dimension to this, and one of the ways in which things have changed is the way in which adoptive parents of who do international adoption are interested in trying to maintain, in some sense, maintain their children's identity.
Absolutely.
And it's really fascinating to read some of the things that have been written recently about some of the children that were adopted from Korea and their experiences, talking about having been raised by American parents, sometimes in small towns and cities where they may have been the only Asian kids,
right,
or that there weren't very many, and that they were raised to be American and to think of themselves as American.
I.e. white.
Exactly. And how now they're actually trying to reconnect with their culture. Now, I think parents who adopt internationally are conscious of that from the get-go. They actually want their children to still have some, to appreciate where they came from, to have some connection with their culture. And by the same token, I think that might be something that some people would feel that would be something they're not quite sure how they would deal with.
Well, I think that's true. I think that one of the results of openness does not mean less complications. It just means better emotionally, developmentally for everyone involved. Openness means that you have this specter of white parents holding Chinese cultural festivals in schools, in their nearly all white schools. It's a very interesting phenomenon. And learning their kids' languages. But the result is that the children simply understand themselves better, are more at peace with themselves. I mean, this didn't come out of the sky with some edict from the Lord saying, you must do this. It is the result of good sociological research, good psychological research, understanding that human beings really want to know who they are and where they come from. And to the best of our ability as parents, we all give that to our children. It's just that if our families are formed biologically, it's so simple. Here's a picture of your Uncle Harry. You look just like him. Well, when I take my kids to a family gathering, they don't look like anybody there. And it is incumbent on me to make them feel like they are human beings who look like somebody who came from somewhere, who have roots somewhere, and not, you know, creatures from outer space who landed in my home. And that is what more and more people realize, that it's simply healthier for everyone involved to have those sorts of connections.
Let me introduce our guest once again. We're talking with Adam Pertman. He reports on family and children's issues for the Boston Globe. He was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, in fact, for his work on adoption, and has also been awarded the Century Foundation's Leonard Silk Journalism Fellowship for Adoption Nation, this book that here we're talking about. And he and his wife have two adopted children. This book, again, dealing with various aspects of adoption, if you want to look at it, titled Adoption Nation, published by Basic Books. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Yet another change is in, it touches on the issue that you talked about before. I think in the past it was the case when people were thinking about adopting children that the people who were handling the adoption had this idea that they wanted it, they wanted these the people and the children to look like they belong together. And so they actually engaged in profiling. You know, they had and they had this idea that we want to make the children and the parents as much alike as possible so that, as I said, so it looked like they belong together.
Right. Now, it was an institutional deceit. I mean, a well-intentioned one, I might add, because social work at the time said, look, the belief was that nurture was so much more important than nature, that nature essentially didn't play much of a role in children's development. And so if nurture was the whole game, well, then you can pretend you gave birth to the child, and the result of which was parents lied to their children all their lives about where they came from. And it was the as-if model. You can continue with your family as if it was formed biologically. Well, again, people meant well. But the result of it was that parents constantly didn't know the answer to their children's questions or had to lie to them or had to deceive them in other forms. And by the way, also deceive themselves. They started to think as though they really gave birth to those children. They knew they didn't give birth to those children, and they never confronted the issues regarding their own infertility. It was not a healthy process all around. Some of the angriest people I know in the adoption world are grown adoptees who discovered late in life that they had been adopted, that they had been lied to all of their lives by the people they trusted and loved most. It doesn't feel good. Most of them get to the other side and understand their parents meant well, but boy, not until they get over some real anger. You don't want to do stuff to, you don't want to make your kid feel bad about him or herself. You know, we lie about secrets. We keep secrets about things that we are ashamed of, not things about which we are proud. Well, I'm proud of my kids. I want them to know who they are. I want them to know I will always be proud of them, and I want them to be proud of themselves. And the truth helps that process, not lies.
We have a couple of callers. Somebody here, one of them on a cell phone, so we'll take them first. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. I've been listening to the program with great interest. I will turn 30 in a couple of weeks, and I was adopted, or I guess I should say I am adopted. And I just wanted to throw out there, I absolutely agree in the necessity of being honest. And my parents were always very open with me, but I just wanted to throw out there that there exists a certain population of adopted children who really aren't interested in pursuing their birth parents at all. And what I've found interesting in the past, oh gosh, say 10 years, as open adoptions have become more and more popular, I've actually gotten a lot of pressure from people to, in terms of saying, why aren't you curious? Why don't you want to search? You know, that's a part of you. And boy, my mother and father could not be more my parents. And so I just wanted to throw out there that there are some of us who really don't have any interest in that search whatsoever, and that should be okay.
Happy birthday. How old are you going to be?
30.
Let me just, can I answer this question in two ways? First,
sure.
Openness and honesty mean you can if you want to. It doesn't. Nobody should ever make you do so.
Right.
Second, what I have found is a lot of people don't start searching, don't start getting very curious about their historical past, their genealogical past, until they have kids.
No, and I understand that because my husband and I are kind of getting into that time where we'd like to start a family, and I do have to say that I have health records, and those records are very important to me because you're absolutely right. That starts to become hugely important when you're thinking about starting a family.
Right, and what I find, I have run into people who are 60 who swore they never were interested all their lives and suddenly say, you know, before I die, I want to know if I have a brother or sister out there. I know my mom and dad probably aren't around, but I'd like to see that. So this happens at all phases. It depends on the individual. The one point that you make that is wonderful for people to hear is that you love your parents absolutely and they are your parents.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
I could not be more their child.
Right. And the insecurity that we adoptive parents can feel is really quite fascinating, understandable, and profound. We worry, oh my God, if she searches for a biological mother, is she looking for a new mom? Well, 30-year-olds don't really usually look for new mommies and daddies.
No.
They have curiosity, they have needs to know, they have lots of things. But it is our insecurity as adoptive parents that we worry, oh, is the birth mom coming back? Is my child looking for, you know, this is not confusion on the children's part. They're secure. They understand who mom and dad are.
No, I agree with that. The other thing is that, and I think part of the reason that I don't have a great deal of curiosity is because things were always very open. Mm-hmm. And because there isn't a huge, you know, great unknown out there that, you know, that people have whispered about or haven't wanted to talk about. And the other thing is that I would encourage anyone at any age, if they are interested in obtaining information, to involve their adoptive parents.
Oh, absolutely.
In that, because
the more
really,
you can, the more
because everyone, you know, just like if when parents get divorced, your dad is still your dad, your mom's still your mom. Same thing.
Very good analogy. It helps a lot of people understand what adopted people feel. You don't. People in divorce don't. You know, we don't think divorce is a wonderful social institution.
Right.
We have come to normalize it. We understand. We don't stigmatize the people involved in it, and certainly not the children, just because they have step siblings and half siblings and all this business. You know, they know who mom and dad are, and they're capable of loving them completely, and maybe even still have relationships with their step parents. Wonderful relationships, just as in an open adoption. Depending on the circumstances, everybody's got to decide their own deal. In an open adoption, a child can love their birth mother perfectly well and perfectly a lot without it depriving the adoptive parents of one iota of devotion or affection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So thanks for your program. I think it's wonderful to continue to raise awareness of this issue.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. We have somebody else here ready to go next in line, and that will be Urbana, and it's line number two. Hello.
Hi. I couldn't listen to the entire program, so I may have missed something in the middle. But you were talking about adoption being less of a stigma, but it being a work in progress. And I've often thought that it must be extremely difficult for somebody who is married but who cannot parent or support another child and already has children to give birth to a child and offer it up for adoption. I would think that that would be extremely difficult, and I don't hear much talk about that. The stereotype is always of the unmarried young woman who who can't parent a child for some for obvious reasons.
More frequently than people realize.
Pardon?
This happens more frequently than people realize, that people who already have children or who are married or in a variety of circumstances just figure out that, usually for economic reasons, but sometimes because of the relationship between the partners, that they're not, they can't or don't want to or whatever the reality, are not going to raise their own child. And it's very complicated. Largely because, for the adoptee's sake, because that, if that person is in fact adopted, one day he or she is going to go find their parents, more than likely today, and they are going to wonder, what do you mean, you were married, you have other siblings, you have other children, and you didn't keep me? That sense of rejection can be profound, and people need to deal with that, people need to understand it. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the stereotype is generally true. It did not arise from nothing, but it is. But there are a large number of exceptions to it.
Well, I really admire somebody who has the fortitude to carry a pregnancy to term and give a child up for adoption. I don't know that that would be my choice, but I've tried to put myself in the... Just think about the woman who is contemplating giving up for adoption and is married. Can you imagine? I mean, she can't just disappear the way some and go to visit an aunt too easily, because she's got kids here, wherever she is, and a husband. And imagine people congratulating her on a better pregnancy and saying, oh, how wonderful it is, and so forth and so on, and assuming that it's fine.
Right.
I would think it would be difficult on all levels. And part of what's getting me to think about this is I have an elderly relative who knows she was adopted out by a couple who already had children,
mm-hmm.
and is trying to, I mean, this person's now in her 70s, so her parents are dead, but she wants to know about the medical history in her family. She would like to find her siblings, and she's not sure how to go about doing that. So I've started trying
to... There are organizations that can help her.
Do you have suggestions about that, or did you already talk about it?
We didn't. In every state, there are organizations that help with processes like this. The Internet is a good place to start looking, not just for your own search, though you can search yourself on the Internet, but also to find people who can help. Just about any adoption organization, reform organization, can help with that.
Okay, thanks.
All right, and we'll go to now we have somebody on a car phone here. Line one, hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a daughter adopted from China who is 4 years old, and she has a very slim chance of ever meeting her birth parents.
Sure.
That makes me sad for her, because I think someday I'd like her to be able to do that if ever it became possible. I'm interested in knowing what research or thoughts you have about children who might want to and will not be able to find their birth families.
Well, this, you're a very good example of what I was talking about before, that parents go abroad and realize that they wish they had more and more information. This is the new world we're entering, and it's wonderful that you realize that, because even if you can't give it, your child truly will always understand that her mother wanted to do the right thing for her. That's a profound and important thing in a child's development. The only answer is that there's often more information than they say there is.
Uh-huh.
Some of the records in China, Korea, we've discovered this in Korea, where there supposedly weren't records, in some places in Latin America where there supposedly weren't records. Persistent parents have found some records. And I think over the course of time, if there is enough pressure, mainly from adoptive parents, I think, China is going to have to fess up and say what they do have and what they don't have. Because the fact is, not every child in every orphanage was abandoned at the doorstep without any information whatsoever. That's simply not true. It may be true in a majority of cases. For those people lucky enough for it not to be true, there's some information there. And it takes persistence, and it may take some time. It may take a change of government in China. But I am told that there are people who have found more information, who have even found birth parents. And short of that, I guess the best thing I can tell you is something you probably know already, which is that the connection to her country, to her province, to her village, is going to make an important difference to her
yes.
as she gets older.
Yes.
She's going to understand that it is also where she came from. And the connections she makes there are going to be important to her. And that may be as close as you can get.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading your book, and I'm enjoying the program very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Let me just mention to people who are listening that we have about 10 or 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Adam Pertman. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe. He reports on family and children's issues. And if you're interested in reading on the subject of adoption, you can look for his book. It's titled Adoption Nation: How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming America. It's published by Basic Books. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Rantoul, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I also wanted to reiterate my appreciation for the topic. I have two adopted daughters. Both of them are from China. And I just wanted to just cover a couple topics, and then I wanted to ask a question. First of all, there is a lot of research on transracial adoptions. Some of it came from research on Native American adoptions into Caucasian families. And what they found was that when there was a sibling from the same cultural group, the children fared better in a transracial family. And I thought that was really interesting. There's also some research on how Caucasian families deal with multiracial family makeup, and particularly from different countries. I think they have segmented it into three groups: ignore the other culture, be aware of the other culture, and completely embrace the other culture and make it part of the family tradition. And I thought that was really interesting. Champagne is really nice because it's got a very large group of parents who have adopted from China. They meet regularly. There's about 40 to 50 families that participate in monthly cultural events. And they're also very active in involving the children in the events of the Chinese Cultural Association in the community. And I think that's a real nice thing for the girls and the families, especially in this country. We purport to be a very multicultural country. The question I had is, what is the difference between a not-for-profit agency and going through a private agency? Because I looked at my costs for both adoptions. They were very similar.
Right.
And I paid about $8,000 to the agency, about $4,000 to various government officials in China, including the orphanage, a couple thousand for travel, $600 for the U.S. paperwork, and
right.
$1,500 for the social work. So I'm looking at this $8,000, and I'm totally not resenting it at all because I love my family. But I'm wondering, what is the difference between a not-for-profit and just going through a lawyer? And again, this is not a complaint against my not-for-profit. Finally, I just wanted to add one more comment about why there's so many baby girls in China. It's not just for the reasons you gave. I mean, China is a very patriarchal, old-fashioned society, and there's a very strong preference for males. And so when the families have a female with the one baby law they have now, if they have females, they're not desired.
Oh, absolutely.
In a lot of reporting on how China has dealt with that, and particularly in the countryside, girls are more vulnerable to abandonment and even worse outcomes.
Oh, no question. That's the main reason. To quickly answer your question about agencies, the principal reason that people go to nonprofit agencies as opposed to lawyers, and that I would often recommend it, is because motives make a difference. A nonprofit agency is more likely, and this is not always true. I don't want to slur lawyers here or make all nonprofit agencies sound like they're doing perfect work. But the likelihood is that nonprofit agency has social workers working for it and maybe running it who understand some of these emotional issues, developmental issues, connection issues like the ones you were talking about, whereas a lawyer or a facilitator or someone who's only in the, quote, business of adoption may not do all of that, may only expedite the process itself. And you do want all of those things dealt with in your life. You do want the information. You do want the social work and counseling. So I think it serves everyone. And lots of lawyers, by the way, do provide it or associate with people who provide it. But I think when you go into the process, we talked earlier about how do you work your way through all of this. I think one thing that you do is make sure you're dealing with someone who gives you sort of a complete picture and a complete package of services and not just helps you fill out all the forms.
Well, again, thank you, and I also am looking forward to picking up your book.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Let's go back to Urbana for another call. This is line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a really interesting topic. I am an Asian American born in this country in my 50s and grew up in a small town as the only Asian kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes when I look at the Asian kids who are being adopted here and their families, I find myself remembering my own experience growing up as sort of an only person. From another culture. And I remember being fascinated by seeing people who were Asian and feeling that I wanted to know something about them. I don't know. I never knew what it was I wanted to know. It was a kind of yearning. And
what did you see when you looked in the mirror?
I didn't see. I mean, I guess I think of myself as of the American culture,
mm-hmm.
and wasn't raised with very much of my own family biological culture, mm-hmm. except foods, things like that.
The reason I ask the question is because some sizable, I'm sure it's a minority, but some sizable minority of people who are raised in white families within strictly white cultures are surprised every time they look in the mirror. I tell stories like that in the book of one young woman from Korea, in fact, who looked in the mirror and was surprised she wasn't white.
Well, I guess I wasn't.
Around her was white.
But my family was the same as I am.
Right. So you saw people who looked like you every day.
Right. But when I think of the kids that I see now, I find myself, just because I have had my own kids, wanting to, you know, reach out to them just because they are adorable little children, and yet also sensing that, and it may be totally erroneous, but that I shouldn't kind of pounce because perhaps their adoptive parents may feel that, you know, they don't want, I don't know.
Maybe you shouldn't pounce. But
well, I don't mean pounce, but, you know, I'm very careful not to kind of just zoom because I have a sense of protectiveness maybe that they maybe want to bond in ways that I don't want to be. I don't know. I guess if I don't feel them reaching out, I sort of keep sort of just the same social distance I would keep with anybody else.
Well, let me address it this way, if I can. One of the real revolutionary aspects of how adoption is changing families today is that social workers and the families themselves have come to realize that needing role models, that children's need to see people who do look like themselves,
exactly.
So they can affirm.
Exactly. That was kind of what my point about remembering my own childhood yearning.
Is a very positive thing for people. I mean, you know, we all want role models who look like us. Kids gravitate toward that naturally, and it is happening more and more in families. What you see happening more and more often is people who adopt children who look different from themselves, either from foster care or from abroad or domestically, you know, as infants, are moving. They're changing neighborhoods. They're changing schools.
So their kids can have more.
So their kids can be can be part of communities.
Well, I was going to go on and say another part of what I experienced as I got older and began to meet other people who were Asian was that in most cases they were, to me, culturally foreign. And my yearning was so much for those who were similar to me, who looked like me, but who had the American culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this person who said that they gather together with groups of people whose family situations are similar, that's important. And I think it's also important that the kids have an opportunity to know other people who are culturally similar to them, which is to say they may look different, but or they are from multicultural families where they are actually culturally American, but so that they don't feel like they're so different. There are others
others like them.
Well, again, you know, my mantra through the book and whenever I open my mouth is that you can't learn anything from secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And now that it's not a secret anymore, we can learn things like what you're talking about. We can try to do better for our kids and for ourselves, I might add. We raise healthier kids and we feel like more secure parents if we're doing things that are comfortable rather than feeling like we're having this uneasy feeling like we're doing something wrong or we're...
Well, I think the kids...
For generations, we adopted parents had that feeling.
Yeah, well, the kids are also incredibly sensitive. They wouldn't want to reach out too far if they thought it made their parents feel threatened.
Oh, absolutely. So, going back to the caller who talked about searching for birth parents, an enormous number, I would wager to say a majority of the adoptees who search for their birth parents, in fact, don't tell their adoptive parents, not because they're ashamed of their search, but because they don't want to hurt their parents and they know that if they tell them, they're going to feel insecure. Why are you doing that? Do you want new mommies and daddies? Didn't we do a good job? And so they've learned through this institution that was built on some level of deceit how to deceive. And that's unfortunate. And when parents, in fact, give their kids their culture and understand their yearning and need for connections to who they are, all of that, it doesn't all dissipate. It can get quite complicated. But it becomes a much less difficult process.
We are, I'm sorry to say, going to have to stop, and I say I'm sorry because there are many angles here of this story that we have not explored. However, if there are folks who are listening who are interested in reading more on the subject of adoption, I would again suggest you look at the book that we've mentioned. The title is Adoption Nation: How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming America. It's published by Basic Books, and the author, Adam Pertman, he's a reporter for the Boston Globe. Mr. Pertman, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
We appreciate it.